Welcome to the EntrePastors Podcast. This show helps pastors think, act, and thrive as prosperous entrepreneurs. And now, here are your hosts, Les Hughes and John Sanders.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the EntrePastors Podcast. I'm John Sanders. I'm one of the co-founders of EntrePastors here with the other co-founder and my friend, Les Hughes. Howdy, Les.
What's going on, John?
Man, my week's off to a great start. Things are going good, so nothing to complain about here.
Hey, guess what I did this morning, bro?
Talk to me.
I booked a flight. Actually, a travel agent booked it, but I paid for the flight to Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Get out of here. When's this going down?
Sure did. Well, man, it's in August. I got to give you the exact dates so we can get on y'all's schedule.
That's awesome, bro. So you're flying into Sioux Falls and then heading out and touring around the state? And
Paige and I, we are.
Are you coming?
We'll be there.
Back to Sioux Falls to fly home, or are you leaving from the other side of the state? Or don't you remember
all
those
details? That's a good question. I don't know, but it goes from there to like Minnesota.
Well, yeah, that just means you're going from Sioux Falls to Minneapolis and then back home.
Not on the way, though, just on the way back.
So you got a direct flight into Sioux
Falls? I think it's right from Atlanta. We'll go Birmingham to Atlanta and then to Sioux Falls, I believe.
You're flying Delta then?
Yes.
There you go.
I think it's like August 12th through the 17th is when we'll be there.
Cool. Well, man, I'll put it on my calendar. I'm glad to get to bring you to the state of South Dakota and show you around.
Yes, sir.
Good stuff.
Yes, sir.
Well, that's exciting news. That warms my heart, so I'll get that on my calendar. And anybody else that's listening to this that wants to join Les and Paige on vacation
just
in August,
come on
up, man. Tour the state of South Dakota with Les and Paige and have a wonderful time. So
that's right.
Well, hey, Les, I'm excited about the interview we got. I know I say that all the time. I'm an excitable guy, but I genuinely mean it. Like, I am passionate about the work that we do here at EntrePastors, and today's guest is going to be a great conversation and really challenging in a good way for our listeners. Ryan Follis is his name, and he comes to us highly recommended as a friend of Austin Brooks. And he has an awesome story about how he kind of came up through the ranks of Target, the corporate side of Target way back in the day as they were blowing up and growing across the United States. And transitioned out of that corporate role into rural pastoral ministry. And so we kind of unpack some of the challenges, the good, the bad, the ugly. But what I love about Ryan and what I wish I could bottle from Ryan and give to so many other pastors in the church is he has an understanding of business. And Les, maybe I just want to park on this with you for just a quick minute. Have you found this to be the case that a lot of times in pastoral circles, business principles get poo-pooed? And if anybody talks about bringing business principles into the church, it's almost held at arm's length, like, no, we can't do that. And it's instead of being viewed as a positive thing, like, we actually have a pastor who has some understanding and some business chops, we view that with suspect or suspicion, or like, that's a bad thing. I've experienced that. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I would say so. I think it's possible still to bring those principles in. They just need to be framed in a different way.
Filter.
You know, rather than say, well, we need to do it like Target, or we need to do it like this business or that business. I think you ought to just show the principle or put it out there and not link it to the marketplace. And that may be, you know, tomato, tomato, but I think that's the wiser way to do it.
Well, yeah, I guess we can split hairs on that, but
I don't think it's the method or the principle that rankles people as much as just what the marketplace is associated with, or you know, so many things get political. Everything seems to go back to politics, and that a lot of things don't get past that.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree, and I want to be careful, and I'm not just saying that the church should begin taking all their marching orders from corporate America and the marketplace. I get where some of that tension comes from. I also, and we here at EntrePastors, are really combating that mindset that is often there, that there's these two separate entities and the two shall never meet, you know, the business place, marketplace, and church world. And I think if we can view this more holistically, we can come to recognize there are some real skill sets from in terms of people skills, leadership skills, and even systems and how to run an organization that if we will open ourselves up to that, the church can learn some things from people that are coming into the church world from that marketplace setting. And I've often found the church to be resistant.
Jesus is the one that said to be, you know, wise as serpent and harmless as doves, and that the people of the world are more shrewd in dealing with their kind than sometimes the people of God. So
yeah,
I think we ought to take that to heart as well.
Yeah. Well, so you're going to hear us tap into some of those themes in this conversation with Ryan, and also he'll tell a little bit about the Midland Institute and the CEO program that he is a part of. He's the lead program developer there and really oversees an incredible program in many high schools across the nation where they're teaching young people how to be entrepreneurs. So I'll let him share more of that. I don't want to steal all of his thunder. But anyway, we've got a great conversation coming your way. We're grateful to have you listening to the show. And without any further ado, let's check out this conversation we had recently with our friend Ryan Follis. Here we go. Well, Ryan, it is our pleasure to welcome you to the Entree Pastors Podcast, man. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Les.
Ryan, tell us a little bit about your work as a pastor, and then we're going to switch gears and kind of follow your story into the marketplace. So talk to us.
Yeah, so a little background for me, the sort of the 30-second life story. I was raised in a pastor's family. My dad was a Methodist pastor for about 20-some years. And then he quit the Methodist church, kind of tried to figure out his, you know, how to provide for his family for a year, and then started a church, non-denominational church, had pretty strong Methodist roots. But for me, that meant moving around. So I went to I went to three high schools and learned pretty quick how to make friends. So if you get into how you become an entrepreneur, a sense of, you know, sizing up conversation situations that are almost survival, right? Necessity produces ingenuity. So I went to college on a sports scholarship, and the coach said, you have to stay during the summer and do all our camps and make pennies unless you have something of purpose. Like, you just can't go and work McDonald's and stay home. You've got to work the camps. So I found a youth ministry position for the summers, did that every summer. And when I graduated college, I had people nudging to go to seminary. So I knew ministry, I had gifts and a passion for it. But I'll give my dad credit for putting a pause on that. He said, you just came out of a Christian college, kind of in a bubble. You're going to go to a seminary and live in a bubble and then go into ministry, and you're not going to be of any earthly good to the people. So Yeah, really was pretty impressive. I think he's also nervous about the amount of debt that would accrue. I didn't have much from college. You know, that was scholarshiped, but the idea of going to a 96-credit master's program, professional master's, right? I didn't really know how involved it would be. So I went to work for Target, and that was probably as I always remind people that my 5 years with Target were about as educational as a seminary. But I had a few experiences at Target that it was pretty much a mindful moment that I needed to be in ministry full time. I had a lot of people come, you know, kind of have a conversation with me in young 20s, mid 20s about their marriages. Had a couple of peers of mine who are also executives with Target that had an affair, broken marriages. Had one of, he was probably about 40, mid 40s. Said, let's go out for drinks. We weren't teetotalers. My dad, sure, growing up, had beer in the fridge for the trustees to work on the house.
Yeah.
So I was kind of, you know, newly informed when I got to the church. And I was like, yeah, we're not, you know, we don't drink. But so to that end, he took me out for drinks. And in about a half hour, he fell off the stool. He was so drunk. I was having a beer. He was having rum and Coke. And so that just kind of was a moment where I'm like, if he doesn't want to go home to his family on a Tuesday night, you know, how am I part of the solution? So it was great. But I went to seminary, got a youth ministry position. Obviously, I had a pass in that. And then when graduated, we moved back closer to family and found a church in rural Illinois where I pastor. Still been there 20 years now.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and this kind of the last piece of that would be, the Affordable Care Act came out, And it did a total 180 on us as a family ministry. I owed the IRS $6,000 in April 2015. And I said, I don't want to do that again. So CEO came around, and I, as a program, you can facilitate. They'd asked me to be involved as a community at large. And I said, well, I'd actually like to apply for the position. It would help the church, and it would help me. So that's, I think, where the church, if some of this conversation is how the church can be more mindful of business. My church caught on pretty quick. They're like, this could save, you know, us some money trying to keep up with the skyrocketing price of health insurance. And then Austin Midland is the brain trust of the CEO programs, said, hey, we love what you're doing. Would you like to come work with Midland? And we have reasons to stay in Nokomis. We had a young man that moved in with us in high school, got married. So they had kids, got divorced. She remarried. She wouldn't let go of our family. So we're sort of a blended family, even outside of our biological kids. So we got 6 grandkids and a lot of reasons to stay. And so the church was content, really happy with the idea of me reducing my role and doing the Midland on the national scale and best of both worlds. So.
So a couple things. I do want to back up to the Target days, but real quick, just to bring everyone up to speed, give us a quick overview of what the Midland Institute is and the CEO program. We've had Austin Brooks on the show, and we've had other guests that he's connected to us that really have tied those worlds together and maybe explained a little bit about that. But just for those that maybe are new listeners or don't remember, give us an overview. What is the Midland Institute and the CEO program?
Yeah, so the Midland Institute is a national organization that creates, develops, trains CEO programs. It's a charter model, follows what you might look at in business world, a franchise model that essentially we give what a program, we guide them through the process to start a CEO class where students get 2 high school credits for taking it. They take it for 90 minutes a day, 5 days a week. And we help programs navigate a CEO board, not-for-profit status, that board is comprised of school people and then business people. And then they meet monthly to help organize that class with and hiring a facilitator who teaches it. The position is a part-time position. And then the students, they go through an experiential learning experience where they're doing business. So they do an initial business venture at the start of the year. And then they do a class business and they're learning teamwork and they're learning partnerships. And then in the second semester, they start their personal businesses with the culmination of which is a trade show that isn't a theoretical. I have people ask me, they go, we do something like that. And I go, it's not. I appreciate that you have them write a business plan and you have them do a pitch for their business. But when the students really get to the trade show and they receive dollars and they make an exchange for a product or service that they provide, it's pretty fun. So that's kind of the overview of the program.
Yeah. Well, we're big fans of Austin and the CEO program. We love what that's doing. And again, we've said before, like, we see this as being a really cool way for some pastors to engage their community in ministry by jumping in and being kind of a local facilitator if their community does not have that. And that's kind of how you got involved with it. Is that accurate? Like, you initially started with your own community and now you're kind of over a national piece of that. Am I thinking about that correctly?
Yeah, actually, and it is an interesting role for pastors who have a little more flexibility in the morning, especially, you know, pastors tend to have a lot of evening meetings and then weekend activities. But we have myself and then others have been in ministry and are in ministry and also are facilitators of some of our CEO programs.
Yeah, very cool. So let me back up and kind of summarize what I've heard you say thus far, and I want to drill back down into something in the early days. But you grew up as a pastor's kid, in and around ministry, saw it from the inside, saw how the sausage was made. Your dad, in his wisdom, I'm going to give kudos to your dad, said, don't just go from this one bubble to the next into pastoring. Like, get out in the marketplace and get some real-world experience. And so you went into Target. Your role there, was that kind of a high-level management thing, or was that just stocking shelves? Like, what did that look like, your time at Target?
Yeah, you know, if you ever, you know, buy property, there's a season for it. Like, it's a great buyer's market, it's a seller's market. Retail for Target was booming in the 90s, and I just happened to catch the wave, which was essentially they hired really beyond your capacity. You know, I was 21, I graduated college young. And they put me in what they call Target College. And you do that for 90 days. And then they immediately make an executive, which they have levels. It was like you could be a level three and be over a department. But right away, they took college, you know, people who graduate college. And they're like, hey, we want you in this fast track program. I had a friend who graduated a year earlier than me, got into it. So he gave me the inroad and said, you know, this is a good opportunity. So they immediately put us as level 10s. And so we were executives. That status is basically you can open, close a store. There'd be about 10 executives to a store over department managers, over level 2s. Level 1s would be, you know, card attendants and cashiers. Yeah, and they wanted you to fast track. They wanted you to have a store by the time you were 30, be a store manager. So
the reason I wanted to drill down into something you said, and you've already alluded to it a little, but you said that that was the equivalent of a seminary education, your time at Target. Say a little bit more about that. I think I'm tracking with you, but put a few more words to that if you would.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So you go to seminary, and I could read Luke 15 and the prodigal son in the Greek, right? You know, an interlinear lexicon that you go through and you study. And then you go into ministry and you're looking at budgets and P&Ls and you're looking at balance sheets and you're trying to navigate offerings and how do you inspire generosity? How do you decide if you should remodel the bathrooms or you should send more people on mission trips? So the financial acumen that comes with ministry isn't taught very well in seminary, at least it wasn't back then. And so you know the Bible and you know your heart is for people, but you know, you get into the weeds of ministry, you have to be a good manager. You have to hire people. You know, not too long ago, I had to let somebody go. It was a difficult conversation, but seminary was not on staffing. It wasn't on, you know, HR. It wasn't about job descriptions. How do you write up a job description? How do you post it? How do you hire for it? Let alone all the things that go into technology, right? How do you manage staff and results that especially in our world today is just so much about, you know, Facebook Live streaming, social media. So,
Okay. Very good. And then also while you're at Target, you're getting ministry opportunity because you're still rubbing shoulders with people who need the Lord and you're seeing, I'll tell you this from my experience, I grew up in an extreme Christian bubble, independent fundamental Baptist, you know, pastor's kid. We had our path marked out. If you leave your church bubble and you go to a very strict college bubble and then seminary and then pastor the church. That was our traditional pathway into ministry. I saw a lot of kids ahead of me go that route. And I'm not going to lie, I saw some really weird kids. And I rebelled against that pretty hard. Not against the faith, but like, I'm not going that route. I'm going to be a firefighter. And that's what I did. And years later, when God, you know, wrestled me to the ground and said, no, I really do want you to preach, because I did my best to outrun that calling I had sensed from a pretty young age. I was very grateful for the years that I had out in the real world, so to speak, working in the fire station with some very seasoned, crusty, salty people. And I think it made me a better pastor. I think I preached better. I think I connected better with those in the issues that people were dealing with because I had seen it, not only from the guys I worked with, but also the calls we responded to. I think I just had a little bit more realistic grasp of life than I would have had I gone off that kind of that traditional path. So here you are in Target. Now you transition into youth ministry. I'm guessing that probably came with a little bit of a pay cut. Is that an understatement to go from corporate Target to youth ministry in the church, or was it a lateral move?
Absolutely shocking. Not only is it less money, we were so young and dumb, we didn't understand how much. In fact, my kids still tease me today. I tell them about money. And my, you know, you have to have some very dark moments to really have the motivation to want to live differently. But we sold the Target stocks. I paid the capital gains on the sales of the Target stocks just to kind of manage survival those first few years of ministry. Went from, I want to say I was getting $45,000 in the late 90s with Target, to a full package salary for pastors. And any pastors listen to this, this is just, you're sort of shocked by it. The whole package says it's 40,000, but you only get paid 20. I think it was, my salary was 22,000. Oh yeah, we were definitely impoverished in that transition. We had the power turned off on us a few times. I mean, it was just a lot of ramen noodles.
Yeah. So I'm curious about the mindset of that, and not that there's really not a right or wrong answer. I'm just curious, what say you to that? If you had the ability to go back and do it differently now, knowing what you know, like, would you take those exact steps? Or maybe if one of your kids was following a similar pathway, would you step in and go, "Hey, there's other ways of doing this," or would you say, "No, go all in, take way less pay and go do full-time ministry"? And how would you handle that in hindsight or in coaching someone into the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think if I went back to that moment in time, I don't know that you can change. You don't know what you don't know.
Right.
I love coaching young people into really understanding their value. So if I did go back, it was funny how I didn't think, true to probably a theme in your podcast, and as I've listened even in the past, that there's a sense of how do you balance the sense of ministry. And we have a real sense of stereotype that you should give it all up for Jesus. If I had to do all over, John, I would go back and negotiate the salary. I thought it was, looking back, part of one of the reasons that I left the church who wanted to keep me after seminary. I'm like, why would I stay? You haven't made any effort to, and this is from success, right? Like, to go in and negotiate a salary, you don't say anything because the board looks at you and goes, these are generous people who give to the church. But that was a church that was very well established in the community, and I could have easily negotiated $5,000-$10,000 more. Great folks, but I
Sure.
think you go into the space of the church where you don't dare talk about a raise or asking for more money. How could you be so selfish? And I think that was my sense in my early 20s, mid 20s, that Target, you negotiated it because it was kind of that capitalistic, it's for profit. Target's making hand over fist. We were growing all over the place. And then you go into ministry and you go, oh, these are hard-earned dollars people are giving you. But then now I'm looking at it, going back to it, going, my salary was pretty much what the utilities and capital expenses were every year. I mean, it was a
Yeah.
big building, had a gymnasium. I mean, we were making a decision to renovate the kitchen and make a commercial kitchen for funeral dinners and activities. It was like, it was my salary.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
But
And I just like our approach with all of this is not coming from a place of bitterness, but there's a tension there that I just want to expose and highlight. And I want to give pastors permission to think differently about some of this, because everything you just said, I totally get. I get that mindset of give it all up for Jesus, be willing to do without, to be far underpaid than what you would in the marketplace. And while I understand that, at the same time, there's kind of that subtle difference of, well, this is sacred ministry stuff, so therefore we can do it for less and undervalue our services. That's just icky, secular, corporate, target, for-profit stuff. And so therefore, sure, it can be rewarded financially. And it's like, I think there's a healthier way for pastors to think about this without slipping into a place of greed or excess, but to say, look, I'm going to make sure that my family is well taken care of, that our power is not getting shut off, that we have maybe a little bit more on the menu than just ramen, unless we are ramen fanatics and just love it that much. But if we would like something more than ramen, we can afford it because we've taken care of some of those necessities. So I think there's a healthy balance somewhere in this tension. And so let me fast forward the story a little bit. Now, here you are in full-time ministry. You've made that jump. You've felt that pinch that many, many of our listeners know very well, that financial struggle. And now you're looking at getting back into some of a marketplace thing. Now, I know you said it was the health insurance crisis of all the free healthcare that we were given that put you in such a world of hurt. Yeah, go ahead. Say more about that if you want.
Oh, I could. I mean, I wrote everybody. I was absolutely livid. We had $3,000 a high deductible insurance, put $6,500 in an HSA, so we're under the $10,000 mark that the church was affording as part of my salary. We had that canceled. They said you wouldn't lose your doctor. Lost the doctor. Said you wouldn't lose your plan. We lost our plan. The five things that were mentioned, we lost all of them. Had to go to the healthcare.gov. They said you had nobody knew how to explain it, so we had an advisor come in who gets a percentage, selling health insurance policies, but goes to the healthcare.gov, comes back and says you're gonna be paying less than you were before. And we're like, yay, Thank you, Jesus. So we paid about $290 a month, and it came in about $300 less than we were paying before for the actual health insurance, put the $6,500 away. But at the end of the year, they said, hey, that discount we gave you, you still get taxed now. Now it's no longer a part of your salary package, a pre-tax, if you will. It is going to be taxable, and the full amount of that health insurance policy before the HSA $6,500 was 11 grand. Mm. We were like, what? So we paid 3,000 of 11 grand. And then they came back and said, you know, your wife went back to work full time and you made more money this year. I mean, nobody explains this to you up front. So yeah, that April 2015, they said you owe $6,300 to pay back for the tax portion. And then of course the rebate that you didn't qualify for. So that was pretty messy. You know, God always finds if you can't get to the door, there's a window. And sure. So we definitely leaned into a solution with the deacons. And to pastors and people listening, I think that's the biggest mistake churches make, is that they just, you don't have enough transparency. You know, again, that youth pastor that wouldn't go to the deacons or the church, when we went there, they brought a wheelbarrow out of all these supplies for us to live off of. Man, the worst thing, this is, they thought this was hilarious. They took all the labels off. They thought it was funny. So we didn't know if we were having soup. We didn't know if we were having beans. You just opened a can and you're like, we're just trying to feed our family, which is, you know, humorous on one end. But really, when you're hardly making enough to survive, too. I turned that around. Now I came back to the church and I said, look, this can't happen again. I can't keep offsetting the difference. So very commendable to my deacons of my present church who said, hey, how do we navigate this? And I said, I think I could, you know, do this facilitating, and it helped the church help me. You got to be more flexible. And so there was a lot of transparency and a lot of good conversations with the church to make that happen.
Okay. That's really what I want to tap into, because I'm frustrated for your reason of why the financial strain came about for you. It makes me want to go out and vote today because elections have consequences, but that's a different podcast.
And when was that? What kind of that come to Jesus time with the deacon leadership? When was that?
That was April
2015. Okay.
Yeah.
That fall I started facilitating.
Yeah.
So I want to tap into that theme, because here's what I'm hearing. I'm hearing you say, at a point of financial crisis in your pastoral journey, you finally kind of went and put your cards all on the table with your church, saying something's got to change. And what I'm hearing you say is what you found, at least in your story, was reasonable people that wanted to work with you, and they were open to ideas. Were you worried about, and again, I'm assuming this was probably a full-time thing that you were looking at taking on, or was there any concern about, I'm breaking the rules of, you know, they're going to think they're losing their full-time pastor, or just that whole mindset piece that pastors struggle with, the identity of who am I if I'm not, you know, full-time sitting in my office 40 hours a week? Like, what did you, any mindset things that you wrestled with as you went through that process of basically asking for permission? I don't know if that's how you would word it, but getting their blessing to be out in the marketplace doing something in addition to pastoring.
Yeah, I think it can be pragmatic. I think there's a real challenge for pastors. I certainly had built up success in ministry. And what I mean by that is that I know pastors want to be humble, but there's a real sense of, are you effective or busy?
Yeah.
And if you're in ministry and you're just busy and you want the church to keep covering your salary, even though the offerings are going down, like we had an investment at that point where we'd been here 10, 11 years, that the transparency developed. Don't let me mislead you. The first 5 or 6 years, there were deacons that actually took a vote that I was supposed to still wear a tie every Sunday, or they wanted to decide that I should be standing up front. I'd play music, so I'd lead an invitational from the piano, and they just, next meeting, they're like, hey, you put us on the spot. You invited deacons to come forward to pray with people. That's your job. Mm-hmm. So there was a real transformation in the church to get into a healthy space.
Good.
And when we ended up doing that, you know, there were years that I took a pay cut, right? The offerings went down and we didn't see the results. But then I also went back to the church when we blossomed and we were growing. And I said, hey, I really could use, you know, inflation goes up, COLA, cost of living adjustment. So that took some relationship building to get to that point. But when I said I could do this part-time job, and assist the church, they were thrilled. So we flatlined my salary. I get a boost with the CEO funds. What I was making as a facilitator part-time. And everybody, actually what we call parallel entrepreneurs, right? Parallel entrepreneurs have multiple things happening, going. I had the church and I had CEO. And you got to ask the question, if you're a pastor, does this compromise or complement?
That's good.
If it compromises what I'm doing, then that transparency, somebody comes up and says, hey, you're really disconnected. We don't see that this is being very helpful. Maybe there's another solution, right? The entrepreneur things, not one or two, but thousands of options and possibilities that we can come back to the table. And yeah, you got to let the deacon speak into your personal life a little bit, in the same way that you speak directly into the church about what your needs are. But CEO was complimentary. I got into businesses. I'm talking to people who actually want me to stick around and would ask me about the pastor side of things, you know, put my pastor hat on. So the church was thrilled. We saw a lot of growth, in fact, even out of that. Just people were like, didn't really know you, knew you were a pastor in the community, but now we see you. I mean, pragmatism. Talk about people in the business world who are like, how do you know so much about the P&Ls and growth, real estate, or you know, operational strategies? I had a business that, you know, he asked me, he said, how do we, just kept me after as a facilitator. He goes, you know, you work with a lot of these young people. We hire a lot of these young people. How do we keep them? It's kind of like we have a revolving door. And so we kind of walked his business space. And I said, one of the challenges of the young people is that you just have all these white walls. And so where they come into the cafeteria space, it's just so bland. I go, you know, maybe you can have a little flair, spice things up, give them a TV, give them a chance to sort of check out from work for their half hour on break. And great conversation. Why is he asking me? He's not asking me that because I'm a pastor.
Right.
So yeah, it was really kind of a wonderful compliment to ministry with both roles.
Yeah. I want to ask you this question. One of the myths basically that I want to clear up often through this show. Sometimes when people hear about Entree Pastors and our mission, they'll say, oh, that's cool. So you're trying to help pastors get paid elsewhere so that the church doesn't have to pay them. I'm like, no, that's not what we said. I'm still very much a fan of a pastor receiving compensation for the work that they're providing and the value they're providing for the church. This is more just the pastor also having the ability to earn an income that is, you know, over and above and meets other needs and desires in the pastor's life. Now, again, if that gets to the point that pastor is able to give some or all of their salary back, praise God. If it's coming from generosity on their terms, not, you know, forced generosity from the church or whatever. So in your case, and you don't have to go too personal into this if you don't want, but I'm just kind of curious, like, did your leadership team, your deacons, did they see this as the first thing I described of, hey, let's let him go get a job somewhere else so we don't have to pay him? Or was it both and? Like, yeah, we'll allow that. We're still going to pay you to produce results here, but we're also going to bless you to be out in the marketplace getting paid to do stuff out there.
Yeah, I think that the church certainly has a tendency to say yes to something until it becomes consequential, right? Like, they certainly really like the fact that there was not going to need to be an increase to match the health insurance expense. And there was probably some hiccups along the way, like when somebody needed me at 7:30 in the morning and I was facilitating. It's a class, so I'm with these students and we're at a business visit or in a host business. When, you know, CEO programs don't meet in the schools. So I'm not at a place that I can just hand this off, ask somebody to come across the hallway. So that's a solid 2 hours. I'm off the grid. And I think we had a few of those. But again, it's seeing the forest for the trees. You know, we were growing and it wasn't really compromising. It was incredible. We adopted a sister church that next year. We still work with them to today. I think where you're leading is kind of a question that the church has to be honest about their business acumen as well, right? Like most churches, 85% of churches are 200 people or less. So you're looking at probably a solo pastor as a full-time salary. And then they have all these part-time positions. So the church is already in this business anyway. Like, to kind of ignore it is to be hypocritical of the part-time positions we have, right? You've got maybe one or two people that can be full-time, but most churches have part-time people that have side hustles, and that might, one of them might be the church.
Yeah. I'm gonna hit you with this question, and you can either answer it from your story or you can answer it as how you would advise a pastor in this scenario. So let's pretend, let's go back to that moment and pretend that when you came to your board and basically said, guys, here's where I'm at, this is what I'm looking at, I kind of need to want to go do something here so that I can make some extra income. Hypothetically, if they would have said, no, pastor, we own you, you're ours, you're full-time, that's why we pay you a full-time salary. Either how would you have responded to that then, or how would you advise a pastor who's afraid of that exact conversation playing out?
Yeah, I think it, so first of all, I think a pastor has to decide, am I employed by the power of the Holy Spirit and I work with the church, or am I employed by the church? And I'll be honest, John, that's one of the things that pastors, I'm pretty bold with that. My church knew that. We had some growing pains where there were some battles. I mean, I've got battle scars from some very difficult conversations with, especially in the early years. But when you get through that, then the church is like, yeah, I mean, you kind of sense like I would not have, it would have been an absolute shock if I'd have gone into that meeting and not known what they were thinking.
Right.
And I think that's a sense that some pastors go into those conversations feeling like they're the employee. Mm-hmm. Now, I have staff. I love my church staff and some part-time people. They're great. So they have a different place. They really do feel like they are the employee, right? And as pastor, as boss, I give instruction. And I think we're egalitarian. I don't think they feel like they're, you know, I'm just sort of always over their shoulder and judgment. But there's a boss relationship that works with those, a lot of our part-time staff that a lead pastor has. But I do second guess a pastor who feels like they're the employee, because what that means is then they're not speaking into the budget. They're not speaking into the giving. They're like, well, you guys take care of that.
Don't you think that therein lies a potential impasse? Because I don't know if exact stats would exist on this, but anecdotally and experientially, don't you think that if you were to ask that question and were to receive an honest answer to pastors, and then let's say the leadership of a church, whether it's a personnel team or deacons or elders or whoever it might be, you would get, I believe, opposite. I think that 80% of pastors or more would say, no, I'm a leader, and you know, I follow the leadership of the Holy Spirit. I'm a servant leader, but leader nevertheless, not an employee. If I'm an employee, I do my work as unto the Lord, right? Yep. So, but I believe that if you would ask church leadership of that, well-meaning leadership would say, I think 80% of them would say he's an employee. Yep. So there's an impasse there.
I would wonder if the first percentage is a little high. In our experience with our sister church, and our church is part of the American Baptist Churches of the Great Rivers region. When I go to conferences, I'm amazed at how many pastors don't think that they're self-employed, right? Mm-hmm. That they are employed by the Holy Spirit and work with the church. These are lead pastors. But remember, churches of under 200, they might be solo pastors. I might have a few people under them. But the conversations usually go like this. John, I go back to your podcasts on loneliness. I think a large percentage of pastors are in that sense lonely, and then run the risk of victimhood and that martyrdom that says, gosh, my church hasn't given me a raise. And you're like, why are you waiting for them to talk to you about it? Yeah. Like, why aren't you getting the organization in the church? Like, you got to lead that.
That's,
you know, good. If you're the CEO of a business, you're the one that goes in to, even, I don't care if it's a board of trustees, you're going to have to go in and have direction for that meeting and for that conversation.
Yeah.
And it builds great, meaningful relationships. But if you're the employee mentality, then yeah, you're like, well, I didn't really grow the church this year, but inflation went up. I still hope the church can manage to give me an extra, you know, like, I'm in that conversation with the two or three people that do our finances. Like, what do you need? What do we need to go back for? A little pushback, you know, where they're like, you know, hey, I don't know that just because inflation went up 10%, we're going to be able to to match that, right?
So. Yeah. Yeah. You know, quick story. When I had a really cool opportunity years ago to go back into full-time firefighting as a full-time pastor of a multi-site church, I really had to work through some of these mental self-limiting beliefs because I came face-to-face with them. In my case, I didn't even know that I needed the financial provision yet. This was a story where God brought the provision before the need, because about a year after I got into that line of work, things on the church income went south quickly. And the two were not correlated. But when I came to my church and I met with the folks, here was my line. I said, look, I have an opportunity to go do something that God has given me a passion for. I feel like I still have something in the tank to give there because I left that career to go into this church planting. And I have an opportunity to do both. And I feel like God is inviting me. And here's what I said is, I'm not asking for your permission. I'm asking for your blessing, because I don't want to do this without your blessing. But a lot of the conversations my wife and I were having behind the scenes at that time were, what if they say no? What if people throw an absolute fit and go, if you do this, we're leaving, or we're going to somehow run you out? That brought me face to face with, do I want to work for a church like that? Now, I didn't think they were going to be that way, because again, we had a fairly healthy church. And like you said, I kind of knew what the responses largely were going to be. Not saying everyone was excited about it, but I just want more pastors to, you know, realize that there's more freedom to them than what they've been led to believe. And some need to step up and advocate for themselves. But man, if they get put in that with their backs in the corner of like, you do this, pastor, and you're done here. Well, there's a lot of churches looking for pastors. And, you know, has God called you, or has this church called you? And, you know, I'm kind of done with that narrative of that church that takes advantage of a pastor and says, no, you stay and keep worrying about the power getting shut off. And here's some canned food that we tore the labels off of. Good luck figuring what's on the inside. You know, ooh, I want to go back and have a conversation with that group of people right now, Ryan. You got me all fired up.
And that's how the church has operated. I mean, there's just been that sense of, that's why I wanted that when you mentioned in that podcast about, you know, can the church open up? Now, I'd take a little bit further what Chaz was talking about. I think it was kind of skiing over some struggles, and I'm referencing that, can churches open up and be business? Chaz, I'd love to reference with him some of the challenges churches face, being a not-for-profit and then a for-profit. And I kind of laugh because I have people that want to rent the fellowship hall. So part of that conversation with the church is genuine, that somebody could push back and go, hey, if this is true for the pastor, now let's extend it to the church. Can the church speak into a pastor who has a side hustle? Can you have transparency and have a conversation about that? Again, if you're not an employee, you do. And I don't mean an employee like you're just totally going against the church's wishes, but with a leadership mentality that says, hey, here's an opportunity for me that benefits the church and benefits the community, also benefits my family. And when they say, well, gosh, this pastor shouldn't be in it for the money, go back to John Wesley. What did John Wesley say? Make all you can so you can save all you can so you can give all you can. I mean, that is, you know, I'm not taking it with me when I die. Mm-hmm. I'm propping it up to be a legacy builder, right? Like, this is where we can create the next generation of leaders in our church by that capitalistic mentality. I mean, what does the money go towards? Well, hopefully it goes to be generous to our community and be charitable. But when Chaz was talking about that, I've got people in the church who are like, well, the fellowship hall is only $50. Can I rent that every Saturday?
Yeah.
So they want to rent it for business. You're like, there's a fine line to that. How you approach the business endeavors of the church, there's scheduling issues. There's a community net loss where you're like, we have a kitchen he mentioned, whether you do like food trucks. And I go, we're in a small community. Our restaurants, it's burdensome when churches do after church potlucks, do meals. I mean, our restaurants lose $500 to $1,000 that day because of the 150 people who aren't going out to eat right after church. So, you know, if you think you could do that and make money, you kind of have a net loss with your community. If those businesses are offended by the fact that you're, you know, using the donation, sort of the not-for-profit side to offer profitability. But it's a big topic of discussion, and the church can't put your head in the sand and act like it's, you know, all for the Lord. Think less, think small-minded. I mean, my gosh, Paul's a tent maker. Peter's a fisherman. Jesus is talking to his treasurer about finances. He's telling him, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. There is a financial business that goes with the church and certainly with ministry.
Yeah, one of the things I love that you said earlier and alluded to is just that concept of pastors having some business acumen and being a part of the conversation in the community and being considered to have a seat at the table, not because of their role as a pastor, but because they understand that world. And I just think it's a shame that the church has so, I'm speaking in general terms here, there's certainly exceptions, but where the church has so removed itself from the marketplace and said, oh, that's business. We don't do business. We do ministry, and created this false narrative, this divide that really doesn't exist or should not exist, that says that's all out in the marketplace. We just do God stuff over here in our little corner. I think it is so to our detriment, instead of having pastors out in the marketplace, understanding what happens in commerce every single day, and meeting the people who are behind all of that commerce and the relationships that are behind all of that commerce. So, man, I could talk for a long time with you about that. One thing I want to touch on this, we're quickly running out of time on this interview. Austin Brooks, who introduced us to you, he brags on you, and you're probably not going to brag on yourself about this, so I'm going to have to coax it out of you. But he's like, man, Ryan has a tremendous heart for the community and invests into the community. And I'm just curious, like, what is he talking about? Like, now that I've outed you and told everybody you have a big heart for your community, put some words to that. What is he, tell me the story. What is he referring to?
That's a good question. I could bring that back, come full circle with my work with Midland. I love John Wesley's statement, and it caught me when I realized that was good with finances with the church. Our church was growing. I really wasn't as concerned for my salary as I was for legacy producing. How do we change lives? And you guys know this. When you see somebody's life transformed, if you gave me the option to have $10,000 more a year in salary or have that life transformative experience, like, we want what we can to live off of and what we can provide for our family. But it's not like I'm looking to be the next Jeff Bezos. Like, right. It's just a constant drive to put back into the community. And so what I think Austin's saying is not totally altruistic. I love being a part of transformational moments, but I also like the creativity that comes with it, right? Like, how do I engage more people? Is this a ministry that we start up? When I went to Midland, come full circle, I had to go have another conversation with the church and say to my deacons that I think, and here's the honest conversation. I'm like, I'm getting older. I don't want to be part-time janitor either. I don't want to keep slinging tables and setting up for activities. And mm-hmm. I don't want to be the smartest tech person at the church. So if I take a lot less in salary, can we get some of those positions filled? And I'll still lead, love my role at the church. But that's sort of flip-flop, right? It was this 50 hours a week with the church and then CEO, and now I'm with the church, but really expanding with Midland. Because Midland on a national scale has that servant's heart. I mean, when we help young people appreciate their value, that's a bottom line. That's got to be the biggest takeaway, is the light bulb when somebody goes, oh my gosh, I'm worth more than that. Or they have a revelation that goes, I'm very entitled, and I obviously think I'm worth more than I really am. Whether it be a pastor who's like, I've been driving this church attendance into the ground, I've been driving the finances into the ground, but woe is me, inflation went up, I need more in the salary, and you're not being fair to me. You go, okay, you've got to have what is your value prop, whether you're a pastor, whether you're, you know, a CEO student who's going to start a business. So,
hey, John, I don't know specifically what Austin had in mind, but I bet I can take a crack at it, because I don't think that Ryan even sees it necessarily because it's a part of his DNA. I think we saw what he was talking about in terms of caring about the community a few moments ago. To me, part of caring for your community is to understand and even to think about how the decisions that you make impact those other families that aren't a part of your church family.
That's good.
Or aren't a part of your fellowship. And there's nothing in the world certainly wrong with having potlucks and doing different things within the fellowship, you know, to really enhance what we're doing and what we're trying to accomplish there in our mission. Right away, though, he began talking about how that impacted other businesses. That's not necessarily normal.
If a pastor
is only thinking about how decisions impact your fellowship, that's one approach. But when you think about, well, let's think about what that's going to mean to other families and other restaurants or businesses, or let's think how, if we do this right here, how's that going to impact families in our schools? I mean, that's just a different, mindset, really. It's thinking more missionally about, or in a missional way, about your community, and just understanding decisions that we make do have an impact on others. My guess is that that's part of what he was talking about.
Yeah, I'll give you a couple of stories that would put some meat on the bone. And to Austin's point, my father-in-law always asked me when I moved to this church in rural America, right? A town of 2,500, a church of 120. At the time we moved here, it was like 60 and a lot of older folks. And so the growth, the transformation, it's not going to set the world on fire. We're not going to be a church of 1,000 in our community. It can, obviously, but my father-in-law kept asking us, how big is your church? The first 3 or 4 years. And we had a period where we grew to an unhealthy 130 in those early years. And a lot of people left the church. And I always tell people we grew from 130 to a healthy 90. And then we could grow from there. But then he came back to me about 4 or 5 years into it. And he goes, well, how big is your church? And I finally just looked at him. I said, it's 2,400.
That's good.
It's caught off guard. What? How'd it grow so fast? And I'm like, no, you don't understand. My community is the church. Like honest to goodness, I was a part of Cecil, Congregational for Excellence, Center for Excellence Congregational Leadership. And a pastor just had me weeping. I mean, a speaker got up there and he said, how many of you pastors, 400 pastors in the room, he says, if you died today, how many of you, your churches would miss you? And 400 pastors are like, my church would absolutely miss me. Who'd be preaching on Sunday? But then he said, if you died today, how many of your communities would even know? And man, I just wept. I immediately went back and I said, we're going to be a community-minded church. Like, our space is available. And that opens pastors up to that business acumen, right? Can we make space for daycare? I mean, think about it. Churches use their space at most at capacity 2 hours a week.
Yeah.
We have these million-dollar facilities and you're going, where's the daycare? Where's the elderly? Where's the lunch, the dinner, the space for people to come and gather? And so, yeah, that's probably what Austin's saying, is that I just see the opportunity for how do we bless others? And when I did CEO, we didn't so much need the money. So the extra money I made more into business. And that's kind of where I grew some real estate. Literally put a sign in the stand, I bought a digital billboard. So we do some crazy stuff, but I'm like, I'm going to buy this old dilapidated building. I'm going to put a sign right in the middle of the town and do advertisement and do, so we have a marketing business for it's on the sign marketing and people buy advertisements. And I didn't get a lot of flack for that because everybody saw, well, what else were we doing with that building? And so there's a sense now as a pastor and also as a community person that we just want to see dilapidated buildings restored, right? We want to see a small town that's in a depressed economy build. And why are we trying to lead that just from the pulpit?
Man, that's so good. You waited till the end of the interview to tell us you got a marketing business and all of this. We're going to have you back and explore that and dig into that some more.
Well played.
I'm always thinking of the title for the episode. I'm thinking this one may be like pastors, paychecks, and potlucks or something like that. I've never thought of that question from the standpoint of impacting, because I'm in a rural community of 2,300 people and the impact that makes. So maybe there's some pastors now that are going to be working with those restaurant owners saying, hey, we're going to do a fellowship dinner after church and we're going to have you guys provide the food for that or something. I mean, it's just a totally different way to approach that. But good stuff. Ryan, last question, and then we got to wrap this up here. The time's going way too quick. Right now, there's a pastor, probably more, listening to this. And they're getting close, man. They're to the verge of, they know they need to do something. They're getting sick and tired of being sick and tired of just the financial struggle and the pressure. And you have an opportunity to speak into their life and just encourage them. What are you saying to that pastor today that's on the verge of becoming more than just a pastor?
Yeah, I think, like I said earlier, consider your endeavors. Are they compromising to your values and your ministry, or are they complementing? But the bigger one I often go back to is, do you have a starvation mentality or an abundancy mentality? Mm-hmm. Do you just feel like everything's collapsing on you and everybody's out to get you? And pastors can play that role as with the best of them. Or do you have an abundancy mentality? Do you really see God's ability in you to create opportunity around you where other people don't see those opportunities? And if you do, it's a pretty fun ride.
It's good stuff. Ryan, if someone wanted to connect with you, what's the best way for them to reach out and get a hold of you?
Probably through Midland Institute, or follow us at midlandinstitute.com.
It has been a pleasure getting to know you, getting to hear more of your story, and I'm grateful for your time hanging out with us here today and adding value to our community. Thanks so much, my friend.
Thanks. Love the podcast.
Well, there you go. Good stuff from Ryan Follis. Guys, go check out the links there that he mentioned in the show notes of this episode at entrepastors.com. And again, just grateful to have you tuning in for this week's episode. Les, before we sign off, this is going to be our last opportunity to share with our audience about a webinar that is the stage is being set right now for this to be the biggest webinar we've ever done in the 2-year history of Entree Pastors with the number of registrations that are coming in for this. We're calling this one Conquering Pastoral Poverty. And man, I've got kind of our teaching lined up that you and I have been talking about. I was just kind of finalizing some of our notes yesterday, and it's going to be powerful. It's going to be valuable. We're going to talk about 5 obstacles that pastors need to overcome if they want to break free of that cycle of barely getting by financially. We're going to label those obstacles, and we're going to give some very practical solutions to overcome those things in this webinar. So tell people, if they've not registered mm-hmm. yet, where they can go sign up to be a part of this webinar all about right. Conquering Pastoral Poverty.
And you know what? If we had branding for this, John, I think it would be that red Ghostbusters circle with the line through it.
Oh, I like that.
But the line would be through pastoral poverty. Okay. So that needs to go. And the so it's April 16th at 2 p.m. Central Time. And to find out more and to claim your seat, just go to entrepastors.com/conquer, and that'll do it.
There you go. Yeah, man, that is at the heart of Entree Pastors. That's what we're about, is we want to help set pastors free from that narrative of being broke. That when you said yes to serving the Lord, that you also synonymously signed up for being broke and barely getting by financially. That's just not how it needs to be in the vast majority of cases. And we want to help break that narrative, change the mindset, and show you some really healthy ways to move forward. So anyway, Les, I love doing this work with you, man. I think we're doing some stuff that matters, and we're helping some people, and I'm grateful for you, my friend.
Yeah, great job.
All right, man. Well, hey, guys, thanks for listening to this episode. We're grateful for each and every one of you. If there's anything that Les and I can do to be of service to you, we invite you to go to entrepastors.com, and there you'll find the links to connect with both of us, and we'll be happy to serve you in any way that we can. So God bless. Thank you so much, and we will see you on next week's episode. See you, Les.
Later.